WHYY at 10:06.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The men accused of gang raping a 23-year-old Indian woman on a bus in December have been formally charged with murder, rape, kidnapping, and other charges. They appeared in a New Delhi court today. The woman's brutal assault and death have led to street protests in India and calls for major reforms in the prosecution of sex crimes. It has also shed light on the problem of harassment and sexual violence against women in this and other countries around the world, our topic for today's Radio Times. We begin with Nihara Mandana, a reporter for the New York Times India Bureau in New Delhi, writes for the New York Times India Inc. blog, and joins us from New Delhi. And Nihara Mandana, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
What can you tell us about this young woman?
Details about the victim herself were kept secret for a very long time till she was alive. Her name was not released, and few details were known of her family, education, etc. But after she passed away about a week ago, we have found out that she was from a migrant from a smaller town close to Delhi, that her family had modest means, that they had put they had made a lot of sacrifices, sold agricultural land, etc., to put their kids through college, that she wanted to be a medical practitioner and was seen as a role model in her community for her hard work and dedication. And I think one of the reasons that her case has struck a chord with Indians of a certain profile, with the urban middle class that comes from large cities like Bombay and Delhi and Pune, etc., is because she was a woman who many found it easy to relate with. She was someone who was watching a movie in a South Delhi neighborhood where a lot of teens and youth go to watch films and shop. She was with a male companion returning home at a reasonable hour at 9:15 in the night. She represented an aspirational India that had moved to an urban center to pursue her dreams. So there were a lot of things about this case that appealed to a lot of Indians.
Well, and I have to say, and I'm not going to go over, frankly, the sadistic, brutal rape and attack that she endured. But what do we know about the men who have been charged with her with various crimes related to her assault and death?
We don't know very much. We know their names at this point. We know that they came from poor backgrounds themselves. We know that one of them was the driver of the bus in which the rape actually took place, and another was a brother, and not much else. Today I was in court while the accused were being produced. Of course, shortly before they were produced, the court was emptied of reporters and lawyers because of the large number of people that had turned up to see what was going on. So that's pretty much all we know at this point. The accused is likely to be in camera. The trial is likely to be in camera, so we won't really see the accused or hear from them, I don't think.
You remarked about the protests, and clearly there have been many demonstrations calling for reforms in India. Looking at the laws and how things are carried out in India, what do protesters want?
When the protest first began, I think it was just an expression of outrage because the details of the crime were so gruesome, that the act was so ghastly, that people were just shocked and angry. And this was a problem that, as reporters, we faced because from the second or third day, we started asking, what are your demands? What do you want? How can the system be better? And we got typically brought, we want more security, we want the legal system to work better, but not really pointed demands at what the government could do to make the city safer, to make the judicial system more friendly. A week after the protests began, I think women's groups and students started putting their heads together and saying, look, here's an opportunity to really corner the government, give them a raft of demands, and make sure that action is taken. So this point demands are for making the police more sensitive so that when rape victims approach the police, they're not asked inappropriate questions, that the first information reports are taken, that women's stories are taken seriously, and that medical evidence, forensic evidence, is treated, kept and stored and produced properly, because oftentimes what happens is such evidence is either lost or not properly stored. The other thing that's being demanded is fast-tracking of trials, because these trials drag on for years. There are appeal provisions, etc. And that's a demand that has been acted on. The government has established 5 fast-track courts in Delhi, and similar things are happening in the rest of the country. And I think there's also a demand for making cities safer, that cities like Delhi, and really this is the national capital, are very male-centric. Transport systems, buses, etc. I'm not from Delhi. I moved here recently, and it's shocking to me how careful I constantly have to be as a woman traveling in this city. There's just this long list of don't get out after 9 o'clock, always have someone with you, you need to be in a car, don't take public transport. So that needs to change.
In fact, I'm looking at a piece Sonia Falerio wrote in the New York Times, who grew up in New Delhi, and describing the exact same thing. As a teenager, I learned to protect myself. I never stood alone if I could help it. And I walked quickly, crossing my arms over my chest, refusing to make eye contact or smile. It sounds like things are not too much different today.
They're not. I mean, Delhi has grown so quickly from being a small national capital with now at least 17 million people. And the city infrastructure in terms of the police force, in terms of the public transport, has just not kept pace. Things like, you know, inadequate bus stops, that things are not lit properly, that the streets are not policed well enough, that there aren't enough female police officers, all of those infrastructural issues, and then larger societal and mindset issues that plague the whole country, but I think are pronounced in the north of the country, of stigmatizing women, objectifying women. I don't think a lot of progress has been made.
I was reading about the Association for Democratic Reforms charging legislators with rape, other crimes against women. Is that also an issue and a problem in India?
At this point, we do have a large number of state legislators who have charges of rape against them. In fact, there are some who have criminal convictions against them that are in the appeal process. So yes, there is a demand to first clean up parliament, to clean up state legislatures, because the men that are going to enact these laws, the argument is that we want stronger rape laws, and the people who are making these laws surely can't be charged or convicted of the crimes that they're trying to legislate against.
It also sounds like questions have been raised about the Indian press, and the euphemism, as I was reading, for sexual harassment is Eve teasing. That's EVE, I guess, like as an Adam and Eve. Eve teasing. Can you talk about that?
Eve teasing is a typically South Asian word, which means sexual harassment. In fact, I want to share with you a conversation I was having with a police officer in these protests, during the protests that were taking place in India Gate last Sunday. The police received 42 calls from female protesters saying they had been harassed during the protests themselves. And I asked the police what the nature of these complaints, what were the women saying had happened to them. And he said, I wouldn't really call it sexual harassment or molestation because that denotes a kind of sustained criminal act. I would call it Eve teasing. Eve teasing is just a word that women's groups and really everyone, all women and youth who have been participating in these protests take offense to, because it denotes a kind of titillating, teasing sort of interaction between a man and a woman, whereas it really means harassment. So being nudged or elbowed on a bus would be Eve teasing and not harassment, or being flashed or being looked at or being catcalled would be eve-teasing.
I was also reading about a young woman, an 18-year-old. She apparently was raped by two men, was questioned by the police, meaning her story questioned. And apparently the elders in her village or her town wanted her to marry one of the men who had raped her or to accept some kind of money. How common, how typical is that?
In rural India, and I am pretty sure this is the same for urban India, it just doesn't come out as much. But it's very common because rape comes with so much stigma and because a woman's prospects for marriage are almost nil if she has been raped, that families typically think that the best possible outcome is that the woman be married to one of her rapists, or that the family be compensated with enough money so that they can get their daughter married elsewhere now that she has the stigma attached to her. I was in rural Punjab a few days ago reporting on a case where a young woman, 18-year-old, was raped by, I think this is the case you're referring
to.
And in the village, there was this overwhelming sense that it would have been the ideal solution. And this is fairly common because village elders make such sort of decisions. And I've been told by scores of lawyers that I've interacted with that oftentimes the police will advise for such a thing to take place, saying, how long will you keep running around in court? This is embarrassing for you and the family. You're a poor family. You can't afford to engage with the legal process. Why don't you instead come to some kind of compromise so that your daughter is happy and your family is saved of the embarrassment? Mm. So sadly, it does take place all the time.
We have about a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, but do you think this particular case will not just change some of the laws in India, but if we're talking about culture, will have some kind of impact on culture?
I do think that this case will have a longer-term impact. I think already the culture of silence that surrounded rape and sexual harassment in this country is beginning to be broken, that women at these protests have been talking about their personal experiences of being harassed, some of them assaulted, others raped, others subjected to domestic violence. So earlier it was that if you're a woman and something has happened to you, that you should be ashamed. There was this narrative of shame, of your respect having been lost, of an attempt to cover things up when they've happened. I think that is, that conversation, that narrative, will perhaps change after this, and we're seeing evidence of that already. I think also in the way that it's being seen now as a huge, as a very serious kind of crime, that earlier there was a tendency to discount the crime, to question the version of the woman, to somehow see that she was involved in it. Mm. I think that there would be a greater seriousness on the part of the police and the judicial system because of the pressure from outside.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you, Niharika Mandana, for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. We'll be right back.
Montgomery School, an independent co-ed day school for pre-K through grade 8, supports WHYY. Montgomery School believes that when children find joy in learning, they are forever inspired to explore their world and are best prepared to succeed in their educational pursuits and beyond. An open house will be held on their Chester Springs campus Saturday, January 12th at 10 a.m. Details at montgomeryschool.org. Montgomery School, inspired to explore, prepared to succeed. Montgomery School supports WHYY.
At the turn of the 90s, bands like My Bloody Valentine, Ride, and Lush came on the scene in Britain and defined one of the loudest and most exciting styles in rock history, shoegaze.
This week on Sound Opinions, we look back at the rise and fall of shoegaze and its lasting influence today.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
At long last, season 3 of Downton Abbey is here.
I'm so looking forward to seeing your mother again. When I'm with her, I'm reminded of the virtues of the English.
But isn't she American?
Exactly.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with creator and writer Julian Fellowes. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We just said goodbye to Niharika Mandana, reporter for the New York Times, and we were talking with her about the brutal rape of a 23-year-old woman. She was raped in December. She died just recently. Five men have been charged with murder and rape, kidnapping, and other charges as well. We are talking about that particular case, but also what it says about gender violence in India and in other countries around the world. Let me introduce our two other guests. Lisa Gernholtz is director of the Women's Rights Division of Human Rights Watch, has worked all over the globe on gender equality issues. And Lisa Gernholtz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Betty, thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Heidi Lehman, director of the International Rescue Committee's Women's Protection and Empowerment Unit. She's an expert on violence against women and girls in conflict zones, has worked in Darfur, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Haiti, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. And Heidi Lehman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And both of them joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. Let me begin with you, Liesl, if I could, and then Heidi, I'd like to hear from you as well. And I just said goodbye to Niharika from the New York Times from New Delhi, talking about this brutal rape and murder of this young woman in India. Do you think this case, Liesl, will shed some important light on the problem of violence against women?
I think what it has done that's extremely valuable has, as Nahara says, has begun to break the culture of silence around sexual violence in India, which has always been a huge problem. I think what is important and what we're beginning to see is that the demands are becoming more strategic and focused. I mean, I think initially, as Nahara referenced, women were talking very much just about wanting to feel safe in public spaces. But I think now we're seeing much more careful thought around the very specific things, the revise of the rape laws in India, training for police to make them more sensitive to women, all sorts of things. So I think it certainly does say something about, firstly, a culture of silence that has been broken, and secondly, about activism, particularly on the part of women and some men in India.
Heidi, let me put that same question to you. I'd just be curious about your thoughts, your reactions, and again, to read about this crime is absolutely horrifying, and of course, underscores the fact that this happens more often than we'd like to believe.
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking about this case and following it, and one person who's captured some of my thinking about it is actually Vice President Joe Biden in a statement that he gave a couple of years ago on the anniversary of the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. And at that time, he said, for every woman who has been beaten in her home, for the millions of women who have been raped as a weapon of war, for every girl who has been attacked on her way to school, for all of the children, girls and boys, who have witnessed this brutality, we must do better. Mm. And when I think about the case of the murder and the rape of the 23-year-old woman in India, in my experience, the brutality, the police experiences, those things feel very similar to the experience I have had with working with women in conflict zones and post-conflict zones. And the narrative of shame that Nihara talked about really, really resonated with me. And even when we're breaking the culture of silence, there's still a significant amount of stigma and shame that the survivors need to get through for justice, for services, and for other things.
But do you think that shame from rape is used as a kind of tool to keep women silent, Heidi?
I think, you know, the shame, I think it can, for sure. I think, you know, with shame comes, a reinforcement of the culture of silence. And, you know, when I think about the women that I've worked with who say, mm-hmm. you know, I want to talk about this, I want to get services, but I want to make sure that if I do, I'm believed, I'm safe, I'm not going to be judged, and things of that nature.
Liesl, going back to you, and even going back to what Niharika was talking about another case of a young woman who was raped, and one of the responses was for her to consider marrying her rapist. I should say that she committed suicide, but the thought of marrying your rapist is frankly horrifying.
It is horrifying, but as Nahara said, it's not uncommon. In my experience working in South Africa, where I'm from, it's very common, particularly in rural areas, for compensation to be paid rather than a criminal prosecution, and for girls to be given effectively, you know, sold, if really, if one's going to be frank about these things, to their rapists. And we have seen that most recently in my experience in Libya, just after the conflict, where there was a significant amount of sexual violence that happened during that conflict. And not only have we seen individual cases of women being forced to marry their rapists, but we've also seen this sort of other narrative where soldiers or the revolutionaries are being encouraged to marry these women because they're seen as damaged goods. No one else is going to want them. You can do this really good deed by taking them in. So, you know, this idea is very much that rape damages women, and either the only person who's going to want her is the rapist, or if you're a really good guy who is willing to sort of take on this really terrible burden. So there's not really a discourse around, firstly, about accountability, that, you know, this is not something that women and girls should be held accountable for, but it should be perpetrators. And also about how women then can access services, both medical services, but also kind of counseling and psychosocial services that can really help them get past it. But it's really, in my experience, not an uncommon scenario that either women are going to marry rapist, or instead of a criminal prosecution, you're going to see payment exchange hands. And you can understand to a certain extent in situations where you have very, very poor families that this is not an unattractive option. And of course, perpetrators and their families know this.
Going back to you, Heidi Lehman, I mean, we're certainly talking about the importance of laws and having laws that allow women and girls to come forward. But nonetheless, I'm thinking about how you change culture, how you change tradition, which seems to me almost harder to do.
Well, it is. It is harder, and it is a longer-term solution. I think, though, you know, looking at what's happening in India and the level of and speed of activism and mobilization, I think it creates a great opportunity for transforming some of the attitudes and beliefs that that really underpin the violence against women and girls that's happening around the world. In our work in Liberia, for example, what we've seen is, as terrible as conflict is, and it definitely has a disproportionate and very specific impact on women and girls, it also presents an opportunity to talk to communities about these attitudes and things that before you would never think about bringing up, especially with men. And in Liberia, we have programming as well as in the Ivory Coast where we do just that. We work with men to try to create a sense of accountability, to create a sense of empathy, to really understand how violence, you know, the decision to use violence not only affects the women but the community at large.
I wonder, and I'm actually looking, and this goes back a couple of months, actually, to a race in Missouri where Representative Todd Akin was asked about his opposition. This was to abortion in the case of rape, and he now famously or infamously said, if it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to shut that whole thing down. To you, Liesl, does that raise questions about our own country?
Well, it certainly raises questions about the level of biological knowledge that people in the public, you know, who are going to be public representatives have, because I think, you know, certainly there was absolutely no medical or scientific evidence to support that contention. But I think, you know, one thing that we need to be really clear about is that violence against women cuts across all countries, all races, all class. So we see a particularly terrible and brutal example in this case in India. But it's by no means an isolated case, and I think there are horrendous cases that we see in places that, you know, I think the expectation is that there's a different sort of behavior. I think if one looks at this case, I forget which state it is, but it's a number of young football players in a small town where sport is seen as the way out. It's something that's very important in the culture of that particular town. And there is a case of a young woman who was clearly very, very drunk, unable to consent, suggestion that she was in fact unconscious for most of the assault, who was assaulted by two football players. The acts were videotaped on cell phones, have been distributed. And I think, again, this is not an isolated case. I mean, I think you hear about these cases. So I think it's really important not to think about what happened in India, something that happens over there that doesn't happen here, because it's really not true. And I think one of the problems often that women in countries like the US or Europe experience is, you know, this idea that they are safer, that if they are reporting rape, it must be something that they did. You know, in some way, it's her fault. She was drunk. She was out late. She was wearing a short skirt. She was already sexually active. You know, all of these narratives are things we see very often in the US and also in other countries like Australia, Canada, Europe. I mean, this is not something that we should see is happening in sort of the developing world. It's really a threat and a concern that women all over the world face.
Do you want to add to that, Heidi Lehman?
I mean, what we know from Department of Justice statistics is that in the U.S., over 1 million women a year are sexually assaulted, and that's simply those who are able to report. So it is, I just will agree very strongly mm-hmm. with that point.
And that is Heidi Lehman, director of the International Rescue Committee's Women's Protection and Empowerment Unit. She's an expert on violence against women and girls in conflict zones. And again, she's worked in Darfur, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Haiti, Liberia, Sierra Leone. Lisa Gernholtz is director of the Women's Rights Division of Human Rights Watch. She, too, has worked all over the globe on gender equality issues. And that's our topic for today's Radio Times, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Heidi, if I can go back to you and actually go back to the Congo. Obviously, working in conflict zones, that puts women, girls, probably boys as well, at some risk for assault. But it seems that Congo is you hate to compare countries, but nonetheless, it seems that the problem of rape is a pretty serious problem in Congo.
Yeah, I think certainly the amount of attention that the Congo has gotten over the past several years, specifically around sexual violence, stands out. I would caution, though, against saying, you know, that that is, again, unique or, you know, and you know, when I talk to the women in Congo and when we work with them, I just think about their response to living in a country that has now been called the rape capital of the world. And so just putting that out there, I think in humanitarian settings across the board, we have paid increasing attention to violence against women and war, but that has been overwhelmingly focused on the public side of violence. So that is to say, Marty, you know, certainly there is a very specific level of sexual violence that is being committed by armed groups. Mm-hmm. But the consequences and the cost of violence that is also taking place in the Congo and other conflict and humanitarian zones behind closed doors is considerable. And to date, it has received much less attention.
Lisa, let me go back to you. And I'm just thinking about what a woman, a girl, needs to recover from rape. And if you're in a country that doesn't have those kinds of services, perhaps doesn't have a culture that's sympathetic to your condition, to your plight, how do these women cope with what's been done to them?
Well, I want to answer your first question first about what women need, and I think it's important not to generalize because I think women respond differently. But I think two main sets of services. One is health services, because rape comes with a number of very specific and often very serious health consequences, including sexually transmitted infections, unwanted pregnancy, injuries, and those do need to be taken care of. And in the immediate aftermath of rape, it's very important that those services are immediately available, because if they're not, you know, women then have to deal with the long-term health consequences of sexual violence. The second set of services deal with how women respond to trauma and the kinds of counseling and other types of support that are needed to really assist them in their long-term recovery. What happens to women in countries where these services don't exist? I think one thing I have seen in my work is that women often support each other, so that where no formal services are available, you will often find groups of women that have formed support groups or informal meetings, you know, that women are able to support each other. And in some circumstances, I've also seen communities, often really when there have been very high levels of sexual and gender-based violence, there will come a point where communities will say it's enough and we want to do something about it. So I think you do see these services, and often, you know, for me, I think what is very moving is that these services are often delivered in really, really desperate and dire circumstances, that women are not only grappling with the impact of sexual violence on their lives, but they've been displaced, they are living in often dire poverty, they're trying to take care of sick adults and children, and they still, you know, are finding ways and means to support each other through this. But I think services is a critical issue, and I think as much as we begin to think about what women need, we need to think about how services are delivered, how they're designed, who funds them, because I think many, many women who have experienced some form of sexual violence don't get any type of services.
You want to add to that, Heidi Lehman?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, you know, for the International Rescue Committee, the way that we look at gender-based violence in emergencies and humanitarian settings is a life-saving, not optional issue. And by that, I mean, you know, oftentimes we think about food, shelter, water, so on and so forth. But the rates and the scale of violence against women and girls in emergencies and conflict mean that it is essential that as soon as a conflict breaks out, we are thinking about and starting to get services in place so that survivors have a place to go.
And those services, I'm thinking of, I guess, the kind of counseling. I'm assuming, you know, human beings, they need to talk about things that have happened to them that have traumatized them. Is that true from your experience, Heidi?
I mean, I think what I can say from my experience is that one of the most important things to do is create a space for women to come together, to come together safely, even if it's not intentionally to talk about what has happened to them. It can be to come together to, you know, to do some sewing, to do some discussion about other, maybe a nutrition issue, so on and so forth, and let it emerge, you know, at the pace that the women feel comfortable with, this sense of solidarity, and when it's time for them to share, they will share. But what is important is that there's somebody there reinforcing the fact that what has happened to you is not your fault. It is not for you to carry this weight. And I think, you know, another part of that is, in addition to, you know, these safe spaces, as we call them, to bring women together as part of their healing, is at the same time thinking about how do we work with a community whose first reaction is to stigmatize, and, you know, even if they don't blame, they judge these women. So very specific programming to work with communities to create a space for these survivors to come back into the community safely.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking with Heidi Lehman, the voice you just heard, director of the International Rescue Committee's Women Protection and Empowerment Unit. Again, an expert on violence against women and girls in conflict zones. Liesl Gernholz is director of the Women's Rights Division of Human Rights Watch. She, too, has worked all over the globe on issues of gender equality. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Give us a call. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra begins the new year with the music of Mozart. Concertmaster David Kim leads an all-Mozart program, Eine kleine Nachtmusik, the Symphony No. 25, and with Imogen Cooper, the Piano Concerto No. 24. Mozart tickets at 215-893-1999 or online. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, the genius of Mozart with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
In the television sitcom Go On, starring Matthew Perry, the main characters connect with each other in group therapy. Feelings and stories are shared. Compassion heightens. The characters seem less alone as they confront life's difficulties. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, understanding various types of group therapy as a catalyst for personal growth. today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. 52 years ago, the Philadelphia chromosome was discovered in a Fox Chase laboratory. The Philadelphia chromosome was the first specific genetic abnormality linked to a specific cancer. Fast forward to today, and Fox Chase is offering a new diagnostic test for advanced cancers. Through next-generation DNA sequencing, tumor-specific genetic abnormalities now can be matched to precision drugs. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We began our conversation this morning talking about the horrifying and vicious gang rape of a 23-year-old Indian woman on a bus in New Delhi, India. In mid-December, she tragically died from her injuries. Her attackers have been arrested. This crime has shed light on the problem of sexual violence, gender violence in India and in other countries around the world. And we're talking with Liesl Gernholtz and Heidi Lehman and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Heidi, before we get our first caller on, I just want to pick up on something you said right before the break about having programs that take into account, I guess, a culture's or a country's unique culture in dealing with the problem of gender violence. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll start by saying, you know, this when we talk about gender-based violence and more specifically violence against women and girls, I think it's important that we understand it as a global epidemic. And as Liesl said, you know, it cuts across class, culture, so on and so forth. And so I think that's important to note. I think in cases where we have worked, whether it's in Liberia or Sierra Leone, the International Rescue Committee, has designed programs understanding that there is not a single thing that you can do to address the problem, but there are multiple things that need to be done. One of those things is working with communities to take a deeper look at how their attitudes and beliefs and devaluing of women set the stage for the violence that they address and one that happens and I think you know one vivid recollection I have is in Darfur and you know talking to a group of imams you know who were basically the gatekeepers. For services and anything else that women were going to do. And, you know, these extremely long conversations around, women being, property and other things and just, you know, really being able to sit there mm-hmm. and have an open dialogue about this in a non-judgmental way, but also with an eye to changing it so that ultimately women and girls are safer.
Were you successful, do you think?
Well, I think in the short term, yeah, in terms of, you know, being able to immediately, you know, and again, Marty, I think it's important to think about what the goal is. I mean, in terms of changing an attitude that was related to these women being allowed to seek health services, we were. And I think that goes back to recognizing that as terrible as conflict is, it is also a transformational moment. And yet another reason why it's important that in humanitarian settings, gender-based violence programming is considered at the outset.
Let me get some callers in. We have David from Wynwood. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
First, I'd like to say I want to salute your guests. They're doing, as they say, the Lord's work. However, I want to dispute the notion that has been stated by one or perhaps both of them, but yet has been contradicted by some of the things they've said. I think what this shows is that there is a difference between the way Western societies, and I'm thinking in particular the United States, and non-Western societies deal with the problem of violence against women. One of the things that I learned from this case in New Delhi which I didn't learn from public radio, was the depraved indifference with which the authorities, the police, and even the people at the hospital dealt with this victim and her male companion. He apparently had to beg for clothes at the hospital. He spent an hour or more going around naked because no one would even give him an item of clothing. And I can't imagine anything comparable to this happening in the United States or other societies.
Well, David, let me take your call. And Liesl, if I can perhaps begin with you on that, he's saying the West is different from the non-West when dealing with the problem of sexual violence.
Let me start off by saying that I'm not from the West. I'm South African, and I was born and educated there, and I lived my first experience of living outside of my own country and off the continent was when I took this job with Human Rights Watch in 2008, when I was, openly on National Public Radio when I was 42. So my experience, both in terms of where I've lived on the continent and my work that has now been much more global, is that there's very little difference in the way that women are treated. So what we see in India, where, for example, she is thrown off the bus with her companion and it's really hard to seek help, is in my mind not very different from when you see a young woman whose images of her possibly asleep, possibly unconscious, being urinated on, being dragged around to several parties, and everybody in that community having seen the images on Twitter and Facebook, them being in the possession of the police, and yet it takes several months before any investigation happens, before anyone is arrested, before there's a trial. For me, from where I sit, I don't see a very significant difference in those two cases. What I do see is that in both cases, there's an indifference on the part of authority to rape. There is an indifference on the part of communities in the way that they respond to women who have been assaulted. So I would really disagree that there's a significant difference in the way that the West and the developing countries respond to rape.
Heidi, do you want to add to that? And then we'll get to another caller.
Yeah, I would agree with Liesl. I mean, I've worked in direct services with survivors in the United States, and I think there is, depending on where you are and depending on how you are perceived, as whether you're a good victim or a quote unquote sellable victim, you're going to be treated inconsistently. And I think that is, that's one of the reasons why the Violence Against Women Act of 1994 was so important, because it set some standards around what survivors could expect.
That act has been tabled.
The reauthorization of the act has been tabled. The 2005 version of it continues. And, in many ways, that was a game changer in terms of Congress recognizing the enormous impact of violence against women and girls and essentially legislating a national strategy to respond to it. And I think it's really important to emphasize that, that legislation was necessary, right, to get not only the services in place, but some consistency around services and to change some of the beliefs that our police officers had, that judges had, so on and so forth, and that are very similar to the places that I've worked at around the world.
Let me get another caller on. This is, it looks like, Carolyn from Center City, Philadelphia. Carolyn, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I was in India a couple of years ago for a year doing research. I was in northern India in the Varanasi. And all of this is part of such a much larger problem of the devaluation of women in India, because when a girl child is born into a family, she is an economic burden, particularly for a poor family, because her destiny is to be married and that family must provide a dowry for her. Now, that is technically illegal in India, but it's widely practiced. So women are seen really as a burden to families. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that in conservative parts of India, women are not supposed to go out by themselves in public space. They must be in the company of a male relative. And while women are disciplined in their home by male relatives, in public space, they are disciplined by any males at all. Mm. And so I see this as part of a very, very big problem. And the fact that young, educated women in the city understand what's going on and have more freedom to move, that's very, very important in bringing this pressure to bear.
Karen, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Liesl Gernholtz, let me begin with you. I'd be curious about your response.
I think one of the things that is important about this case that hasn't received enough attention and that speaks directly to the points that Carolyn is raising is that this young woman was from a rural family, and her family had chosen to prioritize her education. They had, I think I've read reports where they had sold ancestral land, they had moved to the city, all to facilitate her education. So I think it's important to acknowledge that change does happen. But the larger point, I think, is not India-specific. I think wherever we work, there are issues around inequality and how women and girls are valued that need to be addressed. And this is not something that we can say, you know, we've got it in the West, we've sorted this out and it's fine, and now we can work on countries like India and Saudi Arabia and the DRC. I mean, I think there are inequalities. You know, I mean, if you think about something as basic in the US as pay inequity, that women continue to earn less than men for doing the same job. You know, it all goes to the bigger picture of how society values women and what we need to change. So I do think that inequality is a driver of violence against women, and we have to address it in all its forms.
Heidi?
And I think missing piece, I do want to say one thing, and it links to what Heidi was saying, is that I think the missing piece of a lot of work that is going on has been the lack of programming to specifically address boys. And I think we need to be speaking to young men, to boys. We need to think about how they're educated, the messages that they receive from the media, from society. Because I think much of the work that has been done over the past 20 years has focused on dealing with providing services, on understanding what women need, and trying to put those in place. But, you know, what we also need to be addressing is we need to be preventing violence. We need to be creating an environment where it's unacceptable. And we will only do that when we begin to understand what we need to be saying to young men and boys.
Do you agree with that, Heidi Lehman?
I do. I mean, I think prevention is key. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that we have started to look at very specifically in the places where we work. These conversations with men, the conversations in school, you know, they're conversations about making spaces where women should be safe, like their home, like the school that they go to, safer. That's a critical part. Of making sure that women and girls are not only safe from violence, but safe to live up to their full potential.
I was reading about child marriage. Something like 51 million girls are married, I mean, between the ages of 15 and 19. Of course, that's a pretty wide span. Something like 40% of child marriages are in India. Heidi Lehman, do you see this as part of the issue that we've been talking about?
I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, I think it all is connected. And sometimes, you know, certainly in conflict situations, and in my experience, people are like, yeah, but what is the cause of this violence? Really, what causes it? And we continue to go back to, you know, it really is the devaluation of women and girls, and the fact that, you know, the way families see girls are often, you know, as a bride that's going to be married out at 14. Is as Liesl said, a driver of this. I think, you know, in addition to that, I think when we talk about violence against women and girls, it's worth noting that according to the United Nations Population Fund, almost 50% of all sexual assaults worldwide are against girls 15 years and younger. Mm-hmm. So there's a very specific risk factor to adolescent girls around this issue.
Liesl, it's about 3 years since the terrible earthquake in Haiti, and I know you and your organization working there and looking at this issue of sexual assault of women and girls in Haiti. What can you tell us, I guess, 3 years hence?
Well, 3 years down the line, some of the very significant problems that are leading to make women more vulnerable to sexual assault are still there. You have large numbers in Port-au-Prince of people who remain in these informal settlements because they're really not camps in the way that we would understand them. There's no services, they're not being managed. So you have large numbers of, which include young girls and women, who are living in very unsafe, and I mean unsafe both in terms of their health, but also in terms of violence, in very unsafe conditions. You also have a government that remains very weak, that is really unable to show the kinds of leadership around legislative and policy change that would help women. So I think, you know, the downside is that in some respects very little has changed. The place where I find hope in Haiti and other places is that you continue to see women being resilient, women taking leadership roles in these communities, women creating space for other women, you know, these sort of informal meetings that they have that I've seen where women talk about not only the sort of challenges that they have, but they support each other. So I think, you know, that tradition continues. But I think Haiti remains a very, very dangerous and you know, a place where there is, for many people, little hope that things will change in the immediate future.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, Heidi Lehman. Have you been doing this work for some time. Have you seen progress? Have you seen things that give you hope?
Yeah, I definitely see things that give me hope. I think the level of mobilization that we're seeing in India now gives me hope. The fact that, you know, we're even talking about gender-based violence and emergencies as a life-saving issue gives me hope. And as Liesl said, you know, the women and girls that refuse to give up and to be silenced give me hope.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for your work and also for joining us today in Radio Times. Heidi Lehman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Liesl Gernholtz, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Liesl Gernholtz is the director of the Women's Rights Division at Human Rights Watch, worked all over the globe on gender equality issues. Heidi Lehman, director of the International Rescue Committee's Women's Protection and Empowerment Unit. She's an expert on violence against women and girls in conflict zones. And we began our conversation with a call to New Delhi, India, where we talked with Niharika Mandana. About the issue of the terrible gang rape of a young woman in India who sadly died of her injuries. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. Stay with us, though, for Hour 2. We'll be right back.